The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, everybody. It's Monday, and we welcome you to the podcast. I'm so glad that you're listening today. There's a couple things that before we get to the podcast, I want to tell you about. We are in California right now. We're still in Florida. I think we still have people in the Carolinas and also still have people for Hurricane Harvey on the ground here in Texas from Mercury One. The wildfire has killed 31 people at this hour, and it's just out of control. Our hearts, our prayers, and our thoughts are with the people of California, but so are our backs and our hands and our legs, and we are trying to help them out as much as we can at mercuryone.org. If you'd like to donate for any of these disasters, 100% of the proceeds go to these disasters that you earmark. 100%.
Is that where you can buy the raffle tickets too for the car?
Yes.
Because that's what I want.
Yeah. Donate what?
Wait, what? I like Mercedes.
Right.
I think they're fine people, and I think they should give me a car.
All right. Well, that's a good way to donate as well. Mm-hmm. And you're doing good, and you possibly get a new car. You can buy a raffle ticket now. I think we draw on Saturday night. You don't have to be present to win. Somebody's going to be driving a new Mercedes, and you have a really good shot. It's a very small number of tickets that we sell. So please, have at it. Grab your raffle ticket, and I could be calling you Saturday night going, hey, come on down. Pick up your brand new Mercedes.
So on the podcast today, we have we talk about the fires a lot. It's been obviously a huge deal. We have some incredible video and audio here for the podcast of what is actually happening to people going through that.
We also talk a little bit about Tucker Carlson and what he's going through. It's a travesty.
Yeah, no kidding. We talked to Burgess Owens as well, who wrote a book called Why I Stand. He's a former NFL player that says, yeah, maybe standing for the national anthem might be the right thing. It's amazing.
His reason why the NFL is putting up with it is one I have not heard. And as soon as he said it, it made total sense. All on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. It's Monday, November 12th.
Brickhouse Nutrition.
Yeah, Brickhouse is the savior of my life right now because I don't have to eat greens. I hate salads. I hate vegetables. I hate them. I will not eat them in a box or with a fox, but I will drink them down.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the easy way to do it.
Shockingly, Brickhouse Nutrition doesn't necessarily recommend you stop eating all vegetables.
I do.
This is if you're like Glenn or most males in the audience, you may want to try Field of Greens because you get all the nutrients and stuff that you need. You can go through the whole eat your vegetables thing that your mom told you to do and you never did. You can do that with one scoop and juice or milk or water.
Fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to eat any of that crap. I could eat steak and chocolate.
Again, that's not what they recommend. But for a limited time, go to BrickHouseGlenn.com. Use the promo code Glenn. Get 15% off your first order. BrickHouseGlenn.com. Experience a better you tomorrow.
Glenn Beck.
The personal is political. That was a slogan used by the feminists in the 1960s. And like most slogans, you know, it really kind of starts to fall apart once you examine it long enough. But it's generally meant to understood as women and minorities and the struggles that they face directly connected to the patriarchy. And it has come to take on many more meanings, but most of all, it's just a way to say, my feelings equal truth. They don't. Now the personal is so political that the political has become personal, and it is everywhere. Thanks to the radically left-leaning forefathers of postmodernism, every single word we utter now is political. So if anything we say offends someone on the left, it's not just personal, it is a political act. Even worse, having a difference in opinion is a personal insult now. We're seeing it constantly. Ted Cruz heckled out of a restaurant. Sarah Sanders kicked out of a restaurant. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi chased out of a movie about Mr. Rogers. The entire Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, for that matter. And it is escalating. verbal abuse isn't good enough, as we saw last week with Antifa protesters who broke down Tucker Carlson's front door and screamed threats. Yesterday, Michael Avenatti claimed on Twitter that he is investigating Tucker Carlson for an alleged assault on a gay Latino immigrant. Well, this sounds about as plausible as Avenatti's ridiculous claim that Brett Kavanaugh was a serial rapist in high school. Tucker Carlson responded. As is expected, Avenatti wasn't telling the truth, it seems. Officials from the Farmington Country Club, where the incident happened, have confirmed it now. They revoked the man's membership that night. Turns out he was the aggressor. Turns out Tucker Carlson was at dinner with his kids and some friends when his teenage daughter went to the restroom and came back to the table crying. Apparently, the middle-aged man said to Tucker Carlson's daughter, "Are you having dinner with Tucker Carlson?" And she said, "Yes, that's my father." He said, "Oh, you're Tucker's whore." Then he said, "You're an effing C-word." She came back to the table and started to cry. Her brother immediately got up from the table and said, "Excuse me, did you just say this to my sister?" He proudly admitted that he had, and the son, or the brother, took a glass of wine and threw it at him. Carlson wrote, "I love my children. It took enormous self-control not to beat the man with a chair, which is what I wanted to do. I think any father can understand the overwhelming rage and shock that I felt seeing my teenage daughter attacked by a stranger." After his son threw wine, Tucker Carlson got up, and he asked the guy to please leave. They were restrained. Tucker said, "I restrained myself. I didn't assault the man. Neither did my son." He said, "Everything about this is a lie. First of all, I didn't know that the man was gay or Latino. Not that it would have even mattered. What happened on October 13th has nothing to do with identity politics. It was a gross violation of decency. I've never seen anything like it in my life," end quote. This is what I experienced with my family a few years ago in New York. It is the reason in the end that really compelled us to seriously talk about leaving New York. My family was endangered by a crowd of people, and they all thought it was funny. The political is personal. A middle-aged man feels so personally insulted and outraged by Tucker Carlson's political views, his different opinions, that he responds with a personal insult to Tucker Carlson's daughter using the C word. Is this the world that the early feminists with their personal is political signs wanted? How many things have gotten so turned around that it's considered progressive now for a grown man to call a teenage girl the C word? Which I believe is one of the most heinous and degrading words ever used to demean women. Tucker was right to restrain himself. The country club was right for asking this guy to leave and to revoke his membership. It's the best response. Violence is not the answer. We have to keep our head. And it is going to be unbelievably hard sometimes. It gets a little harder every time we see something like what happened to Tucker Carlson. But it is the only way to win. Not everything is personal. Not everything is political. And that is the reality. And your feelings do not equal truth. They are your feelings. Hopefully, if we can keep our composure long enough, hopefully they'll find a better slogan, one that calms people down instead of inciting outrage. In the meantime, we can all agree that no one at all, especially a grown man, should verbally assault a teenage girl because her daddy hurt his feelings.
It's Monday, November 12th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
I, for one, am so sick and tired of hearing from the left that, oh my gosh, they've never experienced hatred like this. Nobody said a word when my family was assaulted in a park in New York. No one said a word. My daughter and I had always wanted to go see a Hitchcock film in the park. And so we did. And I just thought it was going to be fine. I just assumed that everybody was human still. Well, not in New York. And so my daughter and her then fiance and my wife decided to go to the park, and we just spread out a blanket, and we arrived, you know, maybe a little bit early. People started to come. And this group behind us of these 20-somethings, women, believe it or not, they were quite aggressive. They threw wine on my wife. My wife knew that it wasn't an accident because we had security there, and they were able to see their Twitter feed and their Facebook feed where they were admitting what they were doing. I went to the park with, I think, one security agent. By the time we were done, I think we had four. We may have had six by the end. I finally leave towards the end of the movie. I want to get out of there before the movie is over, for obvious reasons. And I get up with my wife, and the entire crowd applauds that we leave. Now, that could have been, I could have, you know, taken that. But not after you had assaulted my wife. Not after my wife and my daughter walk about half a block to go to the restroom. And as they are walking by themselves, they are shouted at and fingers pointed and thrust into their chest saying, "We don't want your hate here. We don't want your kind here. Racist, bigots, haters." When we were walking out, by the time we got across the street, I looked at the security agents and I said, "Go back and get my daughter and her fiance. This is far too dangerous for them." My daughter was already in tears. She didn't know what to do when the security agents arrived and pulled them both into the car. So please, leftists, CNN, don't tell me how hard your life is. I know. I know how hard your life is now, and no one should have to live through that. But what's happening to Tucker Carlson is not an isolated incident. It's been happening from the left for a very long time, and it goes beyond mean tweets. Your family is in danger. And it's only getting worse. So what are we going to do about it? Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to live our lives. We're going to tell the truth. We're not going to play the game that they're playing, because I don't want to be that person. I remember leaving that crowd and saying to my wife, I would be so ashamed if anyone, in my audience treated people like that. If Michael Moore, who was at the top of the, you know, I guess, hate list for the left, if Michael Moore would have been treated like that by my audience, I would have been horrified. But I slept well that night knowing my audience wouldn't do that. It's one of the reasons why we did Restoring Love. I wanted to see a big, huge crowd fill Dallas Cowboys Stadium and treat people with respect. And come together and be good and serve one another and serve the community. The press seems to miss all of that. That's okay. That's okay. We know who they are.
The best of the Glenn Beck program. Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
This is the sound of an angry mob in Pakistan. And they are demanding the execution of a Christian woman for blasphemy. If you're a Christian in the world today, welcome to the first century. Oh, this in Pakistan. Well, yes, it is. And if we continue to have this blasé attitude, the ravenous calls for death of anyone simply for their religious belief, I don't care if it is in China and we are talking about the Muslims that are being rounded up in China now, a million of them in a re-education camp. A million. People are just disappearing. The Chinese are taking on the Christians as well. Christians in Pakistan. Christians in the Middle East, Syria, Iraq. People who just will not accept Islam in Northern Africa. Remember the hashtag, bring our children back? Yeah, that did a lot, didn't it? It did nothing. This morning, I urge you to put a sign up in your front door of your business, tweet, Facebook. We are all this Pakistani Christian woman today. We must be. If you're not hearing about her plight in church, you should be. We have come full circle where the persecution that Jesus and his apostles in the first century had to endure by the Romans, it's now again standard fare in places like the Middle East. But the cowardice I saw from our cousins in the United Kingdom is what truly has horrified me. It is rare to be a witness to such a cowardly act that the British have just committed, and it all centers around this young woman from Pakistan. Here's her story. Asia Bibi, she was picking berries with a few other farm workers in a remote Pakistani field, and this is in 2009. A supervisor asked her to get some water. Well, her life changed forever. You see, Christians in Pakistan have always been on the receiving end of bigotry and persecution. So it probably wasn't a surprise to Asia when two Muslim women began to fight with her, saying that they would not drink from anything that had been touched by a Christian. But it then spun out of control when the two Muslim women claimed she had insulted Muhammad, a crime punishable by death. Now, there are no witnesses. No one can verify this claim, but she has been in prison since 2009. Now, Pakistan's Supreme Court just acquitted her and set her free. Apparently, this is the kind of bad precedent that you don't want to do if you're in Pakistan. You have to condemn a person to death based off hearsay if it involves the Prophet Muhammad. Well, the Supreme Court said no to that, but the mob didn't care. They wanted blood, and they have been out in the streets demanding Asia's death. Crucify her. Now, the only chance she has is for her and her family to get the heck out of Dodge before the mob takes justice into their own hands. So you would think that asylum would be an easy slam dunk. I mean, after all, Europe has been taking refugees in by the millions, quite literally by the millions. So why wouldn't they take another refugee from Pakistan? Well, the UK decided not to grant her asylum because they fear, quote, unrest that might spring up in the British streets from certain areas of our population. Okay, what you're fearing, let me translate British bullcrap into English. What the British are saying is, we have so many Islamists, not Muslims, Islamists here that we have taken in, and they really control our streets. We are too cowardly to even take on the sex ring gangs that are targeting British children. We're too afraid of the Islamists to even do anything about that. The last thing we can do is help this Christian. Because we're afraid. That's really what the British are saying. Where are the people that once said, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender? Where are those people? Where is that courage? Where is that decency? If you want to know what true manifested cowardice is, I give you today's British government. It pains me to say it. And to the women's marchers and the new wave feminists, if you want to know what a real war on women is and real bigotry, try being a woman, and God forbid, a Christian woman, in a place like Pakistan. And now, apparently, in places like the UK. History will say, shame on them. Shame on them. If we don't step in and be who we always have been. The MS St. Louis is a black stain on our history. A group of Jewish immigrants who were being targeted by the Nazis. They went to every country in the Western Hemisphere, including us, and we turned them around. We sent them back to their death. Let's not do it again. President Trump, Mike Pence, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, I beg you, please, grant this woman and her family immediate asylum here in the United States. Now is the time to stand and lead and show the world our compassion and how great we are because we stand for people who are truly targeted. If we fail to stand for this Muslim woman and her family, Christian woman and her family, who is going to die, she will die. If we don't stand for her, what are we all fighting about? What are we all fighting for? What are we all trying to save? What are we trying to convince our friends and family that America is important if we won't stand for her? And should we fail, the world is showing us right now, no one will do it in our absence.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So I tweeted a story from The Blaze, I think it was on Friday or Saturday. Hollywood actor tweets in support of gun control, accidentally admits to breaking California law. There were many ways I could go with that story on Twitter. But it was about Ashton Kutcher, and I decided to go a different way. So I started a thread with him, and it was quite interesting to watch, especially the way it ended. I tweeted, no disrespect, Ashton. As you stated, guns are not for hunting or simply to protect your home. And for those who say you can't fight the U.S. government, see Afghanistan. Plus, school violence is down by 33% since 1993. Gun homicides are down by 49%. Gun crime is down by 75%. He responds, more lives are lost in 7 weeks in the U.S. to guns than 7 years in the Iraq War. Let's make this about data, Glenn. Okay, well, I did in the last one, but I didn't get hostile. I said, okay, let's. Now, first of all, Stu, would you please try to find any verification more lives are lost in 7 weeks in the U.S. than guns in 7 years? Because I cannot find anything close to that.
Yeah, stat. I mean, again, that's eliminating one entire side of the war, right? Like, if you're saying, I guess he's assuming U.S. troops, right?
No, I looked it up, even U.S. troops. I don't, it's not accurate.
Let me look at it.
You look at it. Okay, so he said, let's make this about data. I wrote back, okay, let's. 10 people a day die in a pool in the U.S. 75% of those are children. We could eliminate almost all pools. Yes, the very rich criminal may still get their hands on an indoor, in-ground, illegal pool, but at a much lower rate than illegal guns. Also, suicide was the second leading cause of death among individuals between the ages of 10 and 34, and the fourth leading cause of death among individuals between the ages of 35 and 54. There were more than twice as many suicides, 44,965 in the United States, as there were homicides, 19,362. The reason why I brought this up, I'm missing one of the tweets, is because I said you're conflating numbers here. Also, overdose deaths from opioids, include prescription opioids and heroin, have increased by more than five times since 1999. Overdoses involving opioids have killed more than 42,000 people in 2016 alone. Remember, homicides are down 19,362. We also keep hearing about the shootings, when the truth is a kid is safer in school today than in 1990.
Much, much, much safer. By the way, I was in school in 1990. So I was actually four times as likely to be killed in a school shooting than kids are going to go to school today. That is impossible to believe, but yes, it is absolutely true. The difference, the only difference really is, just to make a quick point here, is that now we're talking about big media events, right? Now it's one kid shooting 13 people at a school, right? And that obviously turns into media celebrity type of event, which again, I argue is a huge driver of this stuff. If the media would stop talking about it, and we've stopped. We do not talk about their manifestos, except for very brief mentions if there's something vital. We never say their names. We don't go into all their reasoning because that gives them what they want. But beyond that, I mean, four times is safe. Back then, it was people picking off each other one by one. It was spread over a much larger amount of the schools. I mean, it happened a lot more commonly because it wasn't necessarily these mass shooting events. They're scary, but they're built for media consumption, and that is a huge driver of this stuff.
So you're four times safer in school today than you were in 1990. And I wrote to Ashton, unless MS-13 is around, they kill four times as many people than mass shooters. And yet, Google MS-13. You will mainly find stories that are anti-Trump. By the way, MS-13 guns are illegal. Then he writes back and says, I'm not isolating the argument to mass shootings. Great, neither am I. All gun-related death and violence down dramatically since 1990. If we want to make a difference, we should join forces to help those in places like Chicago, where strict gun laws haven't helped at all. How can we together stop the killing in Chicago? Then the last tweet is, on another note, I have great respect for the work you do on sex trafficking. I raised money to start Operation Underground Railroad, as well as the Nazarene Fund to free slaves in the Middle East. We may disagree on many things, but not on the value of freedom and human life. After that tweet, others got involved, and the tone by the end had completely changed.
Why don't you tell us what his response? What do you mean others got involved?
Did I miss one of his responses?
I don't know.
That was his response.
So wait, so he came out and
said,
tried three or four points.
Yes.
Failed on all of them and then just stopped responding?
Yes.
That was the approach to the conversation?
Yes.
Was he playing his character from that 70s show?
I'm not sure.
Because I will say, too, that Ashton Kutcher has, you're right, done some good things.
He
said some things that I think have been beneficial. A lot of people just don't know. I mean, you know, when you're surrounded by a media that tells you the reason why we have shootings is because the NRA donated $5,000 to some congressional candidate. Well, of course you believe this nonsense. I mean, you believe the NRA is in control of all gun policy in the United States, despite having literally no power. People can vote for whoever they want. The NRA doesn't make you vote for anyone. People can vote in whoever they want. And still, we're told this stuff. A lot of people, I would assume, particularly in Hollywood, believe it. I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to believe it.
Well, did you see that some doctors were very upset and they said, you know, hey, you know, I see bullets in kids all the time. I work at an emergency room and guns have to be taken off the streets. Mm-hmm. And I'm an expert in this. No, you're an expert in pulling the bullets out of bodies. That's what you're an expert at. You may be an expert at witnessing the traumatic ends to illegal guns. However, when I tweeted back to this doctor, you know, where do you work? What are you in California? Are you in New York? Are you in Chicago? Because if you are, you're in the capitals of no gun zones.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you the bullets that you're pulling out at a high rate are from illegal guns.
Right. You know, there's a big article in the Washington Post. This one came after, I think, the Vegas shooting. But they've been updating it because, you know, it gets passed around every time there's another mass shooting. And it talks about the deaths. First of all, to your point, I think the same way. There's been 25 mass shootings in California. Well, California is a place that has the most restrictive gun laws in America. Maybe Connecticut and Maryland you could throw into that conversation as well. But California is right near the top of making it incredibly difficult. And the cities make it even more difficult. So it's a terrible argument to argue for gun control on mass shootings. The mass shootings are happening in areas with gun control. Of course, we all know that almost every single one of them happens in a place where all guns are banned for any purpose in a gun-free zone. But the entire state of California, which is the place, as the Washington Post points out, is the central location for the most of these mass shootings, has the gun laws that every liberal Democrat would wish to pass. It's a fever dream to pass in California what you would get nationally. In fact, most of these things aren't even things that Barack Obama was asking for. They've gone further than even what Barack Obama was asking for, given the political realities of the United States and the diverse populations represented. So that is, gun control obviously doesn't prove that. But when you look at really like the statistics, I think they get down to 1,135 killed in mass shootings. That is way too many. It should be zero. We all know it. But you pointed out the pool stat, and I'm taking this for, I didn't look this up myself. What did you say? It was 10? Per day, something like that?
10 per day.
10 per day killed in pools. That's 3,650 per year? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, no, it's more than that, I think.
I mean, whatever. It's a lot, and it certainly is going to pass what's killed in mass shootings. Look, it is not comforting.
$10, 10 people a day, 75% of them are children.
It's incredible. And it's no comfort to someone who's, God forbid, been a victim of one of these or have a family member been a victim of one of these. But I mean, the bottom line is that these events are incredibly rare. The odds of you being involved in one of these are so insurmountable that it's almost impossible to stop them. It's certainly, I would say, impossible to stop these things in a country that already has 400 million guns on the streets. You go out there and try to, there's no way to stop them. I believe you can do some damage to this type of event. You can slow down these types of events through media. I think that's, you know, we've talked about studies that have shown that would really do something. You can obviously secure certain areas, but all you're doing is you're going to free up those areas to the shootings to happen in other areas, right? Like, we all talk about school security because we're most focused on trying to protect children. Though, as you point out, it's four times you're four times more likely to be killed in a school shooting in the 1990s than you are today. But we talk about school security just because, you know, here are our most vulnerable people, and it's the hardest to deal with when it happens in a school. But if it didn't happen in a school and we secured all of them with giant walls around them and everyone wear bulletproof vests every day, they just go down the street to the supermarket or they go somewhere else. You're not going to be able to stop them completely. It's just not plausible.
And when you look at California and you look at Chicago, where we have so many gun deaths, what do they have in common? Despair. Emptiness. There is a problem. There is a problem. We know it. We can recognize a problem in the inner city in Chicago. We know there's a problem of fatherlessness. There's whatever. We know there's a long list. California. What's the problem in California? I contend the same thing. Dad might be at home. But those families are completely different in some of these major cities in California. And I don't mean, oh, there's two dads. I mean, the values are gone. The meaning of life. What is the meaning of life? What gives people purpose? It's very, very shallow water in parts of California.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program. And don't forget, rate us on iTunes.
We have with us a guy who played for the New York Jets, Los Angeles Raiders, former, obviously, NFL player and Super Bowl champion. Yes, I just had to check his fingers, see if I could see the ring. Yeah, Super Bowl champion. His name is Burgess Owens, a friend of the show. He's been on with us for a while. He has a new book out called Why I Stand, From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism. How are you, sir?
Glenn, good seeing you again, my friend.
Good seeing
you.
Good
to be back.
First of all, let's introduce your friend here, and we'll get to your story here in just a second. But this is Mac
White.
White. Okay. Hi, Mac.
Hi, how you doing?
How are you? Welcome.
I'm good. Thank
glad
you.
You're here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so tell me the idea behind this book, because you are, you say it like it is, 1910 NAACP.
Well, you know, Glenn, the book basically highlights the fact that what we've done together is remarkable. We have a country that from the very beginning was based on what we the people can do together.
Mm-hmm.
And the history that we've lost is what we've done regardless of race, because we have such great hearts. We reach out to those who are needy, those who are at risk. That's been our nature. And the reason why I brought Mac with me today is because we need to get that done again. We need to realize that there is an invisible generation out there of kids that have not been given opportunities that many of us have gotten. They've not been taught about respect and commitment and love and all those things that we kind of take for granted. And once they get it, they will be our strongest advocates for our American way. I think that's going to be the generation that will bring our country back.
And before we get to the solutions, which is the main point, but you point out that this was intentionally done to African Americans.
Oh, absolutely. Now, what we have to recognize is we're in a fight for the heart and soul of our nation. The Judeo-Christian values we have are very unique. We're the only country that's ever done it this way, and that's why we're the greatest country in the history of mankind. At the same time, we have an adversary, the socialist, Marxist, and atheist, who are anti-God, who wants to destroy us in any way possible. And for those who understand the history of the black community, one thing, for instance, that I don't even know if you know this, but in 1905, Tuskegee Institution, which we've talked about quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
was producing more self-made millionaires than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton combined. Mm-hmm. And this is the way Americans do it when we have freedom, hope, and opportunity. And every race has done the same thing. Those things we have not heard about. But that race, that community, was purposely undermined because it was such a threat to the leftists. So the leftist piece is still there. They're now still attacking our country, have destroyed basically the black family, and we'll get it back. We're in the process now. We have young people like Mac, who's super committed to his family, and I'm excited about what he represents.
Okay, so Mac, let me hear your story. Tell me about yourself.
I was born and raised in Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in foster homes. my mom was separated from my mom when I was probably like 4 or 5. She had me at 20. She kind of wasn't ready to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to deal with the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived with my aunt for a little bit, then basically jumped around from house to house, staying with my dad or, you know, different girlfriends he would have. Kind of really no stable place all the time, because him and my stepmom had like a dysfunctional relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always a lot of fighting and going on and a lot of arguing. They never really learned how to work things out. So it was always he would just leave and pack up and leave and we'd go stay somewhere else or I would get dropped off somewhere. And just by the time I was probably a teenager, I started getting involved with, you know, drugs and gangs and hustling because my dad didn't have a job and his girlfriend at the time, she didn't have a job. So I kind of was like providing for myself for like clothes and food. And when I was 16, I dropped out of high school. And then by the time I was 16, I was charged with 2 counts of aggravated robbery. And I was sentenced to 3 years to Texas Youth Commission in Gainesville, Texas.
How'd that work out?
Which one?
The prison.
It was rough. It was rough. But at the now that I look at it, I think that was the best thing that could ever have happened to me just because of the simple fact that I was just on this path to destruction. And it was just because I had no hope, you know, just growing in the community that I grew up in and the environment and the household, you kind of just grow up hopeless.
So what was the turning point? You found hope in prison?
I didn't find hope in prison. I found just realization with everything that I believed in the streets. The everything that I was looking for in there was the same thing I wanted in my household. It's just that I didn't find it in the household, so I went other places to go find it. It's kind of like a teenager that feel like they can't talk to their parents about something,
mm-hmm.
so they go talk to a friend, but you know they might talk to somebody the same age as them, so it's kind of like the blind leading the blind.
Right,
you're not going to get
right.
the best information from that person,
right.
but that's just the only person at that time that you feel like you can run and talk to. So with my situation was the guys that were in my neighborhood, the ones I felt like I could talk to that could help me, that I would get that love and everything I was looking for in a family out of those gangs or, you know, the friends. And I mean, being 13, you can't really have a job at that age. And we're not taught how to fill out applications.
Right.
A lot of us can't even read. We don't know about finances or anything. The only thing we know is just what our community has to offer. And 9 times out of 10 is selling drugs or robbing people, the only way to survive. And that's what we see growing up as kids. I always say like, I always like to say that a lot of kids never come out of the womb throwing up gang signs or, you know, any of this stuff
yeah.
that a lot of people,
yeah.
And it's something that is taught
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's easy. Kids are so vulnerable. I mean, the first person to get to them is going to have the biggest impact
mm-hmm.
and going to be able to, change their mindset to where they want it to be. And that's what you have a lot of times in those environments too as well. But it's just a cycle because those people are just doing what was done to them.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just say, because the key is there's something that happened that allowed you to change that trajectory. And why don't you explain that to Glenn? Because this is really, when I talk about we the people, what we've done as a people to help mm-hmm. each other, that's really, I think, what I think we can highlight with Mac. So explain mm-hmm. what happened that got you out of that the trajectory you're heading into.
As far as like when
Carmen,
I got out.
Carmen okay. and Steve.
And all right. So when I was in jail, it gave me a lot of time to reflect on a lot of things that I did. And then I start realizing that those things I believed in, those people that got to me first when I was a kid, that I believed in those things. And when I saw what those things got me and that this was the end point right here is jail or either a graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
I had to start finding a new way of thinking, but mm-hmm. not knowing how to because I didn't have anybody to teach me.
My father said to me when I was young, I said, I'm never going to be like you. And he said, son, I'm proud of you. I didn't want to be like my father either. He said, but if you don't find someone to model, you will be exactly like me. And that's kind of the problem. You don't have any place. So where did you find the model?
Okay, so when I got released from jail, I received a card from a lady that was a co-founder on a project called One Heart. Mm-hmm. And she sent me a postcard that had the One Heart project, like the label of like, mm-hmm. I guess they were going to do a film. And it had like all her information on the back, basically wanting me to contact her. So I did. And then when I contacted her, she basically asked me a lot of questions. And just asked about my crime, how serious it was, asked me, what was I doing now? Where did I want to be in life? And just basically just having conversations, mm-hmm. just seeing where my mind was. And I didn't think anything of it. I thought she just wanted to talk to me and then have something to tell at the end of the movie or something like that, mm-hmm. like from mm-hmm. a real actual person that was at mm-hmm. the game. And, she ended up contacting me again, and I met with her and her family. Mother's Day, they drove from Dallas to Houston. It was just me and my dad. Because when I got out, I went back to the same environment that was
that brought you into prison.
Exactly. So that was one of those things. It was like I got out, and then, hey, close the mm-hmm. door, you know, figure it out. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I was blessed enough to actually, what I like to consider her my angel. She came and she asked me, did I want to come live with them, and she was going to help change my life.
Holy cow, that is mm-hmm. risky.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it was risky. Scary for me too, because I don't want to say this, but I can't help it. It's not common for a white person to want to come help a black kid, especially a young black kid from where I'm from, because either they hate us or they fear us. You know, nobody really takes the time to understand us or understand our situation. And a lot of times I feel like the media portrays that, because the news only shows you the two gangbangers that had a shootout, but they don't never yeah. do a story on those gangbangers 10 years ago when their dad was in prison or their mom was strung out on crack and they had to find ways. It's some crazy stories. If a lot of people would hear them, a lot of people would say, I don't know if I would have been able to make it through that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so just... going through that, but back to the topic. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, that's okay. So how has your life changed now? What are you doing now?
So it's changed. When the lady took me in, she put her hand on me, on my hand, and she said, if you come with me, I will take your life to a level you never thought was possible. And at the end of the day, my whole reason for finding that realization that I need to change my way of thinking, I felt like this was what I needed right here to help me completely change that, mm-hmm. and then also take action. Because I actually wanted to make some out of my life. I just didn't know what I wanted, because I never dreamed past 21, because I didn't think I would make it to be 21 or even be a free man at 21.
What do you do now?
I do acting, modeling. I do speaking like mentoring, but individually, like on my own with like younger people that I've encountered with that I want to help.
Can I say this? I've taken Mac and spoken to about 30 young people in the juvenile system, and they are mesmerized by his story, because what he does best is leave the message, if I can do it, you can do it. He takes away excuses that you can't. He takes away the thought you cannot make in this country, that this is a place you have a second chance. If given it and you go for it, you can change your life.
I don't know anybody that could make it in today's world, especially African Americans, after being told all the time, young girls now, you're not going to make it. The system is a rape culture. It's against you. I grew up in a poor family, and my father was, you know, a small businessman, kind of a failing businessman, Willie Loman kind of guy. Suicide in my family, divorce, blah, blah, blah. We've all had our share of problems. But the one thing that was instilled in me was, you can do anything you set your mind to. And if you don't have that, and in fact, you have a society telling you this society is against you, you'll never make it because of them. And see, you don't have a chance.
And my story is, I grew up in the Deep South, Tallahassee segregated community, KKK and Jim Crow, and very successful community, though, because in that the community, there were people who believed in our country, they believed in God, they believed in the family unit, and their goal was to show those who didn't believe in them that they can make it happen. So for me to look back 50 years later and see the message that you see, you're so correct. The messages are so different now. For us to tell young people like Mac that you can't make it in this country is stealing their dreams. Mm. It's the worst that Americans do to another American. And yet we have it. It's a business now. People make millions of dollars by giving the message of hopelessness. And so this is why we have to recognize if we're going to change the trajectory of our country, we need to make sure our kids know that this is the greatest place in history of mankind.
Tell me about your great, what was it, your great-great-grandfather?
Oh, great. Thanks. Great-great-grandfather Silas Burgess came to this country in the belly of a slave ship in 1848. Sold on an auction block in Charleston, South Carolina with his mother. Mm. His mother either committed suicide, took her life, or escaped. She couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
The heinous things was happening to her. Mm-hmm. And so at age 8, he was an orphan. But he had men around him that believed that they still had hope. And they escaped. They took the southern route of the Underground Railroad, wow, facilitated by Mexican and German Americans, and made his way out to Smithfield, Texas, where he became a very successful entrepreneur, owned 100 acres of land, bought it 2 years, started the first black church, first black elementary school, pillar of his community, Republican, proud American. Mm. And that is what the American way is all about. It doesn't matter how we got here, as long as you have hope. And that's what people like Mac, I think, is the future of our country. They're finding out that this is a place that can make it if given the chance, if given hope. And once they get that, it's like the Harriet Tubman that I've come to love when I was a 12-year-old kid. She not only escaped, but went back 20 times, mm-hmm, helped 300 people because that was her love and empathy for people. And that's what Mac is doing now. He's going back and telling these kids, you can make it, you can do it, I'm here to help you, we'll make it happen. And he'd helped his four or five of his friends to come out after they came out of the same situation. And that's the heart of Americans. So we continue to do that. It doesn't matter what color we are. It's who we are. It's those values we have inside of us that say there's a God in heaven, that if we do the right thing, we give as much as we can, that we'll be blessed, and they will be blessed in the same process.
Tell me what you think is going on with the NFL and the kneeling.
Okay. First of all, we have to recognize the NFL is not the same as the days we grew up. You know, Al Davis and Pete Rozelle, they're globalists. And globalists do not prioritize our country. They see their profitability across the world, and that they've done purposely the last 3 years. Wonder why it's taken 3 years for them to figure out how to deal with this flag thing. They wanted to demean the NFL brand, very simply, because they have places like China, France, Mexico. There's over 68 countries that already have a presence in, mm-hmm, and they're looking at having the Super Bowl in London. So at the end of the day, they want to make sure they demean the brand enough so it's accepted in China and all these other places that don't really care too much for our country. It's a global stretch. They don't mind giving up or sacrificing these kids' careers. That's what they're doing. These young men are not only sacrificing their careers today, but their brand. When they leave the game, they will not have the same power of to move forward as those days.
Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
I mean, so, he's done pretty well for himself.
Well, and what they do is the whole idea of use, abuse, and discard. He will be discarded eventually when they figure out they don't need him anymore. The leftists are very heartless people because it's all about themselves. And so you understand the NFL. What I like to do, I see the NFL do, is apologize for the last 3 years. I think at that point, they're trying to do now is trying to move forward. They just had a big thing with Veterans Day where they're mm-hmm, showing how proud they are. Mm-hmm. And you don't see too much of this crisis right now. They've been able to push that down. They want us to forget what they've done the last 3 years. It's just like the Democratic Party does the same thing. They have been a menace to the black community for centuries, and they want to kind of help us forget that they were the bad piece of this process. So I would love to see the NFL not only apologize, but tell us what they did with the $90 million that they put into this social justice. Where is that now? And how's it being used? And I don't think we'll ever find out how that's all worked out.
You know, when you said this, when we were off the air, I was like, that is I can't believe I didn't think of that. People don't understand in America that we are just a market to many of these companies now. When it comes to NFL, you know, we're a market. You know, we're just one of many, and they've maxed out their growth here in America. So now, what do we do to get Mexico and other places around the world to except NFL, like soccer, yeah. World Cup. And that's really what's happening. I'm glad you brought that up. I would have never thought of that.
Well, I mentioned this when we were off air, but the commissioner just got signed a contract of $40 million per year. Keep in mind, only 10% of that is $4 million is guaranteed. The rest, 90%, is based on growth. Their growth started tailing off 3 years ago. They capped at $3 billion in the United States, and they're going south ever since. So they have to get that internationally. You wonder why Nike stepped in. Well, Nike gets all their money in China. That's where their big payday is very little bit, comparatively speaking, here in the United States. So if they were to put Colin Kaepernick as the Marxist he is, as their brand, the champion, it's very attractive to Chinese people. So
have you heard that anywhere, too?
No.
No, really,
you have to really have to think through how bad these people are to really get to what they're capable of doing. And I think American people haven't gotten there yet. They don't quite understand how devious the leftists really are.
Do you? I mean, your book is full of stuff like that. But I want to take you to a more positive place. That you say, how long have we known each other? 4 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You say just in the last 4 years, the world has changed in the black community. What do you mean?
It is. I am so excited about what's happening. I think the greatest present to our country was President Obama, because he showed how much of a failure liberals and socialists and Marxists can be. We have people in the black community that has so much hope that he's going to be the savior. And when he failed after 8 years, they realized, wait a minute, what happened here?
You never hear about his failures. How do you mean?
Well, when you look at the fact, I'm going to give you just a couple, just so you know how bad things have gotten. 75% of the black boys in the state of California cannot pass standard reading and writing tests. 83% of black teen males for the last 8 years could not find jobs. 70% of black men forsake their families. I mean, I go to a litany. You go through the increase of welfare. What the leftists do is they understand that misery is how they get their power. So they do everything they can, and they lie. They pat you on the back and give you a big hug as they're giving you misery. But what's happening is that now that we're where we are, black folks realize my misery didn't go away. So you have a President Trump who, of course, doesn't do it politically the way it's supposed to be done, but the results are there. We now have less unemployment than ever in the history of our race. We're now talking about education. We're talking about prison reform, which has never been talked about. All the things that now bring hope to people, we're now finding. And we have many young people now, not just the older folks who came from the generation I did, where we saw the success. Mm-hmm. Younger people are getting it, and they're leaving. There's a Blacksit now. We're leaving. Black leaving the Democratic Party. There's a walk away.
Really believe that's happening?
Well, what's happened?
To a real significant extent?
Here are the numbers. We have 16% of black Americans that were for candidate Trump. It's now 36% for President Trump.
I've never seen that with a Republican or conservative candidate.
Well, because blacks are feeling it. When you start to see jobs coming, you start to feel hope, it's a whole different ballgame, and we're just getting started. My goal, very simply, is two things. It's education, and it's ownership. And ownership, basically, is not just being entrepreneurs, but it's owning your future, realizing that you can actually make a difference in what you do and be accountable for your actions. We get that message, which is now going to be starting to happen in the black community. And we'll be the community that we were back at the turn of the century, where we were literally the example of what can happen when a community got it right.
Have you met African Americans who have read your book and see things like, for instance, just talk about the NAACP and the way it started?
NAACP was started back in 1910. It's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The problem is it wasn't started by colored people. It was started by 21 white socialists, Marxists, atheists, race-controlled Democrats. Mm-hmm. And they had a black socialist, W. DeVos, who was a facade. And they did through stealth, they got into our community and switched our community. At that time, was leading our country in the growth of the middle class, capitalism, patriotism, you name it.
It was the most successful, even in the 1960s, it was the most stable family in the country.
That's exactly right.
I mean, what happened from slavery up until about 1920, 1930-ish with the black Americans was amazing what they did. And then it was just dismantled.
Well, Glenn, you've talked to your audience. I've heard you talk about Black Wall Street.
Yeah.
We talk about Madam C.J. Walker, who was the first female self-made millionaire in our country.
People would say that that was Oprah Winfrey. It happened a century before her.
The first Black millionaire on Wall Street was in 1840, and he died in 1875 with a wealth of $250 million today's dollars. So there's a cess going on. We don't hear about it. That's what the left does. It's called, it's what Karl Marx said, the first battleground is the rewriting of history. You steal our history, you steal away the vision of our future and our pride in our past. And that's what they've done. So we're going to get that back.
So when you have people who are African-American who read this, do you have, and don't know what you do, do you have them come back to you and say, oh my gosh?
I've had some. I think, though, what I love is that I'm not the only voice out there now. This is what's exciting to me, Glenn. There might have been a deal 10, 15 years ago that I would have been a big, big deal because this is such a new voice.
Right.
Like the Shelby, there's a few guys, Walter Williams and a few others.
Right.
Now I'm just one of many voices out there. And so it's nice to see that people are reading. I think, though, the key is the venues like this is what we, the people, do. It's not just Black voices. Is Black and whites together doing things and realizing that color has nothing to do with it. We all have issues. We're all trying to get through this thing called life. And if we give back, no matter what color we are, we all win at the end of the day.
I just think you're a miracle in today's world, and I'm always pleased to have you here. The name of the book is Why I Stand: From Freedom to the Killing Fields of Socialism by Burgess Owens, available everywhere.
Thanks, Glenn. Burgess.
You bet.
Seeing you, Anthony.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.